Welcome to this 31st day of July, the last day of July.
It's my grandmother's birthday.
Well, happy birthday.
114.
It's my sister Carol's birthday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's not 114.
Is your sister Carol alive?
Yes.
Well, then she's ahead of my grandmother.
There you go.
There you go.
It's the 31st of July, and it is the last day of July, the first day of August tomorrow, and summer's going by quickly. Welcome to our panel discussion this morning. We have quite a... quite a talk ahead of us, I believe. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Joe.
Ooh, a subdued Alan. And WAMC newsman Ray Graff, who we've been talking about his grandmother.
Yes.
And our special guest, Professor Christine Chung, co-director of the joint Albany Law School, University at Albany Institute for Financial Market Regulation. We will talk about that in a moment. But what does joint mean? I mean, in the sense of, wait, at the top of your paycheck, who's there?
Albany Law School.
Okay, all right. There you
go. Thank you for having me. But yes, I teach at Albany Law School, and you know, but we work together closely with our colleagues at UAlbany on this joint initiative. So,
now you are an expert in. We're going to be talking about. Basically, this comes out of the Detroit bankruptcy case.
Correct.
And you are an expert in this in municipalities, their economies, and quite frankly, their fiscal woes. So there's a story out yesterday. A U.S. bankruptcy court judge has set key dates in Detroit's case that indicate that there's an intention to accelerate the process, to try to get through this as quickly as possible to get the city back on its feet. My first question for you is, how hard is that to do? To even with an accelerated process, the road ahead for Detroit is a long one, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this really is a marathon, even if we can find a way through the process quickly. I mean, these problems have been developing for many years. Yeah. You know, the city of Detroit's economic woes have been building, declining population, declining tax base, expanding need. So we're not going to resolve it tomorrow.
Now, is this a forerunner for other municipalities? And in other words, can we expect what is happening to Detroit to be happening to other places?
Well, I would say that as a technical matter, municipal bankruptcy is rare. If you look at it compared to corporate bankruptcy, it's far less frequent, and it's more complicated for certain legal reasons. So I don't know that we're going to see a lot more municipal bankruptcies. But there are a lot of things other than bankruptcy which are pretty much as bad.
So we keep hearing about Syracuse, for example, facing some of this. But I wondered if the state, after all, the cities are creatures of the state. We all know that. So therefore, does the fact that you're in one state or another make it more likely that you'll go bankrupt?
As a technical matter, it can. Like, for example, Harrisburg has just been through a process, similar sort of financial woes. The city tried to declare bankruptcy, and they were not permitted to declare bankruptcy because it's not automatic that a city can declare bankruptcy. It's sort of a combination of state and federal law. That being said, like I said, there's other things. You know, there's receivership. There are emergency powers given to managers. There's a lot of things that can happen, whether you're technically in bankruptcy or not. And I think that's what we have seen, what we're going to see. Cities on that edge.
You know, in Springfield, Massachusetts, they had all sorts of financial woes, and short of bankruptcy, I don't even know if it got to bankruptcy, but they had basically a board running the show. Was that discussed with regard to Detroit as a resort before this?
Well, Detroit actually had an emergency manager in place, Mr. Orr, Kevin Orr, who tried to work out a solution by bringing together stakeholders. So, you know, we have a few key stakeholders. We have taxpayers. Who are ultimately the ones who have to repay the municipal bonds when the city borrows money to do stuff. So we have taxpayers, we have public workers, right? And we have, you know, bondholders, the people that loaned the money for the city to do the things that it needed to do with respect to infrastructure. So, you know, there have been a number of cities that have had managers of some sort or another, people other than elected officials, put in to run the show during times of financial distress.
Including New York City.
Yep. New York City had a debt crisis back, a bond crisis back in the 70s.
Gerald Ford to New York dropped dead.
Yeah.
You know?
Your most recent article is Municipal Securities, the Crisis of State and Local Government Indebtedness, Systemic Costs of Low Default Rates, and Opportunities for Reform, better known as a beach read.
I was just going to say that. It's exciting, paint drying all around us. Yes, it's okay.
Hey, you know,
we can make fun of low review articles.
But however, You know, this is a discussion. I mean, I was watching a piece on NewsHour last night about this very thing of you know, what other cities are facing this? But we look at this as a tragedy for Detroit, and of how something can get that out of control. That being one point to look at. The other being, well, okay, yes, a tragedy, but what can we learn from that?
Right. You know, I think you're absolutely right, Joe, that both, we ought to take both lessons, right? How did we get here and what can we do? And how did we get here can be a combination of systemic problems like declining employment base, thus declining taxes, declining population, so fewer people to pay more in taxes for basic services. I mean, in Detroit, according to the Mr. Orr, the emergency manager, it's taking like almost an hour to have police respond to a 911 call in some instances. Lights aren't on. I mean, a fundamental failure to provide even a reasonable level of services. So that's a tragedy. And how do you get out of that? And I think this is the thing we need to look at carefully with Detroit and frankly with Harrisburg and the other cities that have been through. What do you do? Because it is not easy.
But we're sitting here in the middle of, you know, Albany, but we're talking to people, you know, parts of six states. The word pensions comes to mind.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't even imagine the tragedy that some of those stakeholders are facing right now as they sit there and know that they may get 10 cents on the dollar, I read.
Right. You know, unfortunately, there aren't easy fixes. And you're right. I mean, we have public workers who may have worked for the city. I mean, when we say municipality, by the way, it can be town, village, city. Mm-hmm. It's not just a city, you know, in that name. But we have people who've worked for years and are now sort of staring down the barrel of not having what they thought they would. But I would say that there are a lot of people wearing white hats in this story in the sense that, you know, it's not the taxpayers' fault either, right? We have city, you know, workers owed money. We have taxpayers who really can't afford the promises that were made 10, 20 years ago. And we have bondholders. And when we say bondholders, it's important to remember this isn't some sort of necessarily some big bank exploiting taxpayers and workers. This is you and me, because the majority of outstanding bonds, municipal bonds, are held by people, not institutions, but people through their own retirement funds, through municipal bond funds. So, you know, I mean, there is a story about the banks here. And from my perspective, fundamentally, that involves complex securities, things like swaps and derivatives. And we can talk about that. But there's three stakeholders, each with a compelling story.
I wonder if we could backtrack for a minute and discuss bankruptcy itself. In other words, what does it mean for a city? We know that if you're a person or a family and you go Chapter 7, you go Chapter 13, your assets are divided up, measured, and that's how it works. But a city seems like a much more complicated procedure.
Yeah, it really is. And that's why cities can't automatically declare whenever they want to. There's an interplay between state and federal law, and sometimes state law will prohibit a city from declaring bankruptcy. So what does it mean? I mean, you know, it is different from personal bankruptcy and from corporate bankruptcy. You can't force, for example, you can't liquidate a city.
Right.
Right. You can't just sort of put it all up for auction and say we're selling the streetlights. So it is a process. And the idea behind bankruptcy for a city, as for people and corporations, is to give the city breathing room to restructure its obligations so that it can work out a plan that's viable going forward. And this is where the sausage making comes in, because this is where the bondholders are there, the pension holders are there, and sort of a realistic appraisal of what the people can pay for.
Because you still have to run the city while you are reforming the city.
Absolutely.
Your point to the, using Alan's example earlier of city in California, of saying, okay, well, we're not going to let you declare bankruptcy. But I wonder,
Pennsylvania, but yes.
Harrisburg, but there was also a city in California, I thought.
Yep,
But my question is there a point where you say, okay, but by delaying this process, we're getting further in the hole, and we're not getting that breathing room that we need. Also, we don't want to do it too quickly, because then that also can be an issue.
Yeah, it is. The timing of this and how it plays out is tough stuff. And I would say, with respect to the decision whether to file bankruptcy, whether you can, whether you can't, you know, one of the things, for example, that happened after Detroit declared was that there were press reports that other cities in Michigan were now having to pay more in terms of interest payments on municipal bond offerings that they were trying to do. So there's collateral consequences. States don't want cities to declare bankruptcy because it has an impact for other municipalities in that state. Excuse me.
I have some rich friends, and they have.
That's good, right?
Can they help Detroit?
Could you give me their number?
Now, these rich friends have been telling me for years about buying munis.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you were just referring to.
Yeah.
Because there are real advantages to buying municipal bonds in terms of taxing and the rest of it. But also, if in fact they start to fail, the price is going to be affected by that.
Yeah, I would say a couple of things. I mean, municipal securities were traditionally marketed as widow and orphan securities, meaning safe for, good for people who can't take a lot of risk. So why is that? Well, that's because municipalities rarely default. If you compare the municipal default rate to the corporate rate, why don't they default? Because there are these legal restrictions on their ability not to pay. There is pressure from higher levels of government to stay current because it has impacts for other borrowers. And because, you know, for many kinds of these, for many municipal bonds, particularly general obligation bonds, they're backed by taxing power. So there's an obligation to tax. And that's one of the things that's very interesting, you know, to the extent that law is interesting about Detroit, is that the emergency manager tried to essentially do a workout that would have had the general obligation bondholders getting less, because they usually stand in line first and they usually do okay.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. I forgot my question. I got too wrapped up in your question. Okay. The question I had was, you know, moving forward, if you're a person and you declare bankruptcy, well, you can kiss your credit cards and mortgages and everything goodbye for 7 years. How long does it take Detroit then to get their credit footing back?
Right. You know, that's a really good question. And that's, you know, often what state officials are thinking about is, you know, what does this mean for the city and what does it mean for the rest of the state? So I would say that what you know, for better or worse, often what you see with municipal bankruptcy is, or municipal distress, is that there's a real attempt to get those bondholders paid. And we can debate whether that's the right answer from a policy perspective.
Right.
But for example, I think Harrisburg last week, there was a report in the New York Times indicating that they finally had a deal. This is Pennsylvania. And it would result in basically the bondholders getting paid. Mm. In a city in California that also went through bankruptcy in the recent past, ultimately the bondholders got paid. And again, to me, that's a tough policy
but
question.
But the pension guys may be getting 10 cents on the
dollar.
That's
exactly right. And not only may the pension guys may not, you know, not get what they thought they were going to get, but the city is still facing reduced services.
So what is the predictable indices here? I mean, for example, we see what happens in Detroit.
Yeah.
Down go the car companies. They lose population. Could we therefore look at municipalities which have one industry, stranglehold? So, for example, we know that GE, for example, had tremendous positioning in some of our towns, Pittsfield and in
Pittsburgh, Schenectady, and things like that.
Right. So should we be looking around the country to see where there's one industry town?
A one-horse town?
Yeah.
I mean, that's certainly something to look at. I would say the other key driver of fiscal distress in cities are post-employment benefits, pensions. Right. I mean, the mayor of Syracuse has been very vocal talking about the difficulty, you know, the city sort of being upside down, right, owing more to the formers than to the current.
And in fact, there's a big fight between her, Stephanie Miner, and the governor.
Exactly.
The governor offered a plan. Joe, Ray, you guys know more about this than me, but wasn't there a plan in which he said, okay, you can pay later as opposed to pay earlier.
Right. The smoothing.
Yeah.
Right.
Smoothing.
And she said that's forestalling the problem.
I certainly agree with her.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, there is, you know, again, the money, the obligations don't go away. I mean,
money is still needed at some point.
Exactly. Or you work out a scenario where, you know, everyone is equally unhappy, right? I mean, you know, that's a settlement, right? So, but my point is that the obligations don't go away. You either pay them eventually, or you work out something where you don't pay as much, and it's part of a resolution, and that's what's going on in Detroit. I mean, the manager tried, was unsuccessful. you know, largely because people wouldn't accept the treatment of the bondholders that he was proposing. And he declared, and that gives him a stick to try to bring people to the table.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. I want to get back to a point you made earlier about not only how this affects Detroit, but how this affects the state of Michigan. You look at Harrisburg, and Harrisburg is a large city, but it's anchored by both Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. So it seems to me as though the statewide impact would be less. But Detroit is a major city in a smaller state. It would seem to me that that would have a huge impact on the state as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. I think what the market will be looking at is what happens to these general obligation bonds. And again, I don't mean to be like boring people to tears with like the municipal bonds.
Well, that's usually our job.
Yeah. Okay, good. Then I'm good. But the point of it is that if at the end of the day, those bondholders see something less than, if there's a real concern that those bondholders aren't going to get paid, then that's what will have an impact on the borrowing capacity of other towns or the price at which other cities and towns in Michigan can borrow. And so that people are watching that very, very carefully.
Do you see this imminent anywhere else in the country in the short term?
Do I see bankruptcy imminent?
Yes.
I do think that there's some other cities around the country, that are on the edge. And I would say, to be clear, sometimes cities get in the soup, if you will, because of the sort of systemic problems that Detroit is facing that I think, I think we've done some things right in New York that have been helpful, but I do think we have the declining population, pressure on the tax base, and expanding public service needs and pension obligations in many, in upstate cities, okay? Sometimes there's sort of this perfect storm, like Canajoharie a few years ago. It was a one-horse town, beach nut, flood,
right?
Problems,
yeah.
Can I
hold you?
And they did not declare bankruptcy, I want to be clear.
We have to go to a break, but I promised you that you could leave at 9:30. But are you able to stay for a little bit?
Yes.
Excellent. So let's go
lock
to a break.
Lock the door.
And when we come back, I'd like to talk about Canajoharie a little bit and then and contrast that a little bit with other towns throughout our listening area. We are delighted to have Christine Chung with us. She is co-director of the Joint Albany Law School and University at Albany Institute for Financial Market Regulation. We'll continue our conversation on our roundtable panel after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Dutchess County Arts Council, a sponsor of the Wasaic Project, presenting their annual summer festival, a weekend-long celebration of art, music, and community, August 2nd through 4th, wasaicproject.org. Dr. Victor Zinus, Woodstock, providing holistic dentistry, author of Healthy Mouth, Healthy Body, Living a Longer Life, Your Tongue Never Lies, 845-657-2322. Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking, rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com. In the Bee's Knees Cafe, Preston Hollow, New York, serving their farm-raised grass-fed meats and poultry, buffet and a la carte, Saturday and Sunday, heather-ridge-farm.com.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. We always welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Joining us for the discussion, of course, Alan is here, Ray is here, I'm here, and our special guest this morning, Professor Christine Chung, co-director of the Joint Albany Law School and University at Albany Institute for Financial Market Regulation. She previously served as branch chief of the Enforcement Division of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, among other posts, and it's a great pleasure to have her join in our discussion this morning. We've been talking about, really as a jumping off point, we've been talking about Detroit and their bankruptcy, but basically talking about municipal bankruptcies. When we left, I wanted to focus in on Canajoharie for a moment because you were speaking to Canajoharie. Here is a town which was Beechnut was the big business in town, and they left.
Mm-hmm.
And so where does that, and as you pointed out before we went to break, Canajoharie has not declared bankruptcy.
No.
But what is their fiscal picture right now, and what can we learn from their situation?
Well, I think we can learn a couple of things. Number one, they were dependent. There are a couple of businesses in town, but obviously Canajoharie had a big, Beechnut had a big footprint,
so they
literally
make gravy
and figuratively.
Master.
Yes, they do. But, if you go there, right, there's a huge factory right there and, right off the thruway.
Right.
And you know, that obviously was a major employer and a major payer of water and sewer taxes. It was sort of a use system, and they were obviously the biggest user. The village itself, the population is quite small, right? And there were a few. There were obviously some other businesses, but
2,000-3,000 people, whatever.
A couple thousand people, ratepayers basically,
and a great public radio station.
You know,
absolutely.
Not to say exactly. So you know, when Beechnut left. That was tough. Right now, from the state's perspective, the state was able to work with the company, which had changed ownership various times over the years, but they cited, they built a new facility in Florida, New York, so kept a lot of that upstate at the time, right? Which is great on one level, but the problem is
we save jobs.
Yeah, but it's a separate water and sewer system, which again is sort of minutia that I know sounds like paint drying as I say it, but but the point of it is that the people, the Canajoharie people still owed that money. And they had borrowed money to upgrade water and sewer, both to hopefully meet Beechnut's needs, but also to comply with environmental regulations. They had been getting, you know, the state had essentially said you need to upgrade to comply with regulations. So they had done what they were asked to do and what frankly, towns across the country do to get business to stay, which is to give, to do things to make the infrastructure better and more attractive. So, you know, when they leave and they're no longer paying, I mean, the city, you know, worked tirelessly to try to work out, to try to smooth the landing, if you will. Worked with state officials, worked, you know, with the company, worked locally, and were able to, you know, mitigate some of the impact. They tried to get a new tenant, you know, and those efforts obviously are not going to go away. I mean, but, you know, they still owe the money, and absent, you know, essentially attempts to work it out, combination of state help and just, you know, making good on your obligations, you know, it's not easy. It will not be easy. I mean, again, I give credit to the local officials who sort of dealt with the problem forthrightly. And I think the city did, the village did a number of things right. But it doesn't make it any easier to have the conversations and to make the choices that you have to make to decide, are we going to meet our obligations? And they have worked very hard.
So let me ask a complex question, and so complex I'm not sure I actually in my mind completely have it formed. Let me give it a shot. You look, and this is a scenario. Just take this as a scenario. But let us look at the city of Albany or Malta, where we have put in now a huge investment in nanotechnology.
Yep.
And we have a public-private partnership. A part of the state university system, as far as nano goes, in Albany, and you have all of these major companies moving in. Okay, if nano goes bust and something happens and those companies leave, are we in better shape because we have that private partnership as opposed to all on the public dime, or are we still going to feel very real effects? Another way of asking the question is, have we learned from some of these problems so that the setup with pensions and municipalities is better to deal with the blow of an industry leaving?
You know, I think it's an excellent question. And, you know, I think you're really pointing to a larger issue, which is, you know, what the heck can you do? And have we learned anything from the problems that we've seen in cities and towns and villages around the country? You know, and I would say this. I mean, you know, the model of villages and towns and cities being these sort of standalone islands, which have their own services, and once you reach the border, kind of the snowplow lifts up, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And we don't I mean, that model is a tough one to maintain because, as an economic unit, the city of Albany, for example, is no longer an island, right? You have people that work in the city but may live outside the city. You have people that live in the city but may work in the suburban, you know, the office parks around the region. So I think hopefully we've started to learn that these solutions to these very intractable problems require cooperation at every level of government. And we need to look at the economic reality and not just the borders. I mean, you know, Detroit is actually... It's a fairly geographically dispersed, you know, the borders are pretty big, excuse me. And so, you know, you're looking at a large group of people dependent upon services. You know, I think with Albany and with upstate cities, we're an economic unit as a region. I think hopefully we have begun to learn that in having public-private partnerships that are not just dependent on one city.
No, but you know, it's interesting. New York City is trying to figure out how they can get everybody who works there to pay full taxes in New York City, and this has become a huge legal issue.
In Philadelphia as well.
Yeah. So I live in a little town, Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Smithsonian Magazine says it's the best in the country. And right next door is a little town where I used to be a selectman, Alford. Yeah. Now, Alford offers pretty much no services other than the education that they give the kids and plowing the roads. Great Barrington has a huge police force to catch middle class speeders and other things. And the tax rate is huge. Mm-hmm. And you talk to somebody from Alford and they say, why should I live in Great Barrington? You know, I can live 3 minutes outside and have this wonderful tax thing. So when you start talking about cooperation, that's fascinating, how localities sort of compete with each other.
I think that's a reality of, you know, America today, is that when a business is deciding where to site, it essentially says make me a deal. They say make me a deal, right? And there's pressure on municipalities to offer incentives and so forth. And you know, you're right. You do have a competition for business and competition for residents, because people will say when they're buying in, I'm looking at the school taxes, I'm looking at the property taxes, you know, and so forth. Where should I live? And you know, there are, I'm sure, people that would say, I'll live in Alford and I can drive to all the cultural amenities of the nearby town. I mean, you know. I mean, again, I'm not being critical of either residents of either cities, but I think that, you know, frankly, if we do nothing else other than trigger a difficult conversation about how we pay for the things that are important to us, like, that's worthwhile. Because I don't care where you live, but certainly up here, we have some hard choices to make, right? That's an unpopular thing to say. You know, I don't make friends when I say we got to think about pension obligations, municipal bond obligations. We need public officials to
size of the police force.
You know, exactly. And I don't think that anyone, you know, I think we need to have a conversation as a group about what do we want? What are we willing to pay for? How can we pay for it? And we want our public officials in particular to take a long-term view about what's sustainable. Again, makes me very popular.
but we're not good at that.
We're not, Joe. You're exactly right. And you ought to come to a Great Barrington town meeting someday. And up steps the police chief and says, we need 3 new cruisers or 2 new cruisers. And there's a sort of a low-pitched moan. But nobody, even though it's a secret ballot, nobody is going to dare think that in the back of their mind, hey, what if they don't show up? Same thing with the fire department, which asked for Great Barrington, for goodness sakes, a humongous new fire pumper that you would want in New York City for sure. Nobody is going to say no.
You know, is part of the solution, do you think part of the solution is consolidation of municipalities? I mean, Governor Cuomo's been talking about that.
Yeah, there has been, and I know that there have been some votes around upstate.
They're not very popular.
No, it's not, and I understand why, because, you know, frankly, you know, you want to know the man or woman who plows your street, or, you know, I mean, we like having that relationship, and we don't like having municipal services kind of outsource, for lack of a better term, or we don't like to not know.
Yeah.
And
how about Dade, for example? Has that worked out? Do we know, because their municipal services go across this huge area now, that there was this coming together of various municipalities? Has it worked?
I don't have the latest and greatest. I would say, you know, I mean, it's a story that's not fully written yet.
Yes.
I mean, but in any event, I mean, I think that if we have to at least have a conversation about it, because otherwise, you know, if you think about a resident of Detroit, who, according to the receiver, people are waiting an hour for a 911 call.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't, you know, however you feel about consolidation, nobody wants to be there. Highest homicide rate in the nation. You know, you can't turn the street lights don't work. I mean, a complete degradation of public life. I mean, I don't think, you know, there's obviously a gulf between debating whether you want the highway department to coordinate with the town next door and that. But the reality is that, you know, it's not cheap to run cities, especially cities with aging infrastructure, you know, in northeast climates where you have, you know, so we do need, I mean, and fundamentally, you want people making decisions not just for today, but for tomorrow. So whether that decision is what bonds are we going to offer, A million decisions work out better if we think about them over a longer term, particularly pension obligations and municipal bonds, because these are obligations paid over time, especially in the future.
But it seems that the goal, and not that this is a bad goal, but the goal is always when it's a political season, is the economy and job growth. Mm-hmm. Job growth, job growth, job growth. We're going to bring more business in, more business in, more business.
But if you pay to bring that in, Joe, if you pay the piper, then the taxpayers are, if you think about it, paying that bill.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So if you pay,
And you make them a deal, right, to come right. in, and you say, you're not going to have this tax, you're not going to have that
long?
Tax. And then for how long? And are you going to stay around?
You know, Puerto Rico did that. And very interesting, with Operation Bootstrap all those years ago, they say, okay, you got 20 years. 20 years, bye-bye.
Yeah.
You know, goodbye.
Yeah.
I'm leaving now.
Right. Well, you know, that is...
But this brings up your question of priorities.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
and I think of having these discussions, and I don't know, and getting back to the point Alan made, I mean, we're not good at having those discussions. And in that meeting in a town... in a village or a county basement, you know, you may have 10 people there who are going to be paying attention, and probably they're there because they have one particular issue that they're ticked off about.
Sure. If you tell Alford, let's combine with Great Barrington and assume a lot of their taxes, what are you, crazy?
Right. No, you're, I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's easy to sort of say, well, it's Pollyanna-ish to think that we could ever have difficult conversations. Like, I mean, you know, I'm enough of a cynical person. I get that.
Me too.
But I would also, but we do, I mean, you have to remember that, you know, at least with respect to municipal bonds, some we vote on, some we don't. We rely on our public officials, okay?
Right.
So essentially, they are buying a mortgage for us. Because that's what municipal bonds are. It's a loan.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. They're buying a mortgage. Okay. And so, wouldn't we want them to be at least as diligent as we are if we're fortunate enough to be able to afford a mortgage and buy a home?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't we want them to say, okay, what am I paying over the life of this obligation? Okay. Or what, you know, wouldn't we want them to exercise that same degree of diligence when they're negotiating for? Public worker contracts. You know, and look, I'm from this region. Many of my family worked for the state and currently work for the state. I am not down on pensions at all. You know what I mean? And obviously, you know, the pension benefits available to workers who have been with the state for many years are greater than the, I mean, you know, we've been having difficult conversations.
Yeah.
And no, you know, it's, everyone's felt pain here. So I'm not picking on any one of these stakeholders as being, I want mine and I don't care about you, because
right.
I don't think that's the case. But I think, you know, recognizing that it's hard to get people excited about this conversation and it can be technical, what we can do is ask our public officials, what's your take on this? What's your approach? How, you know, we want, they are our mouthpiece. So
but
we
they
want to
stay in office, right, Christine?
They do. No, I mean, that's the trick. I mean, they want to, but I think that if you know, I at least want to know, like, look, if you're mortgaging the future because you want a quick hit, like, that matters to me as a voter. Because many of us have families, older, younger, like, they're going to be paying. Like,
sure.
We're all going to be paying for Detroit,
but for
right?
years, we have, every time a governor asks for an environmental bond issue or one of those things, I go on and I say, but can we afford it down the road? Can we pay for it? And the answer is, you wouldn't buy a house without a mortgage. You couldn't afford it if you didn't get a
right.
mortgage. And now you've put it right in perspective for us, because it's easier to do it down the road to let somebody else pay for it down the road.
I mean, it's sort of like an adjustable rate mortgage. Sort of
sure.
back during the crisis,
i.e.
right?
our kids, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, but I mean, it's easier to say, well, you know, the bank comes to you and says, well, you can pay less today, but, you know, there's some risk that if interest rates change, you know, your rate may go up.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, that's not very different than some of the conversations that happen around municipal bonds and the products that are offered to cities and towns. So, you know, I mean, just before we went on air, there was a report, I think Angus King was on the air, and he was from Maine, and he was talking about a bill that he and Elizabeth Warren and I think John McCain, though I could be wrong about that, are introducing, and the sort of the tagline is make banking boring. In other words, we don't need so many bells and whistles. We just need solid products that are financially sound. I mean, that it's a complex bill, but in some respects, you know, a simplification of municipal finance wouldn't be the end of the world, where we have a clear, we as normal people, as civilians, can understand how much is this going to cost. Mm.
So this is where the comptroller's job, which we think is boring, mm-hmm. Becomes very important.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, in New York, our comptroller has been, has tried to shine a light on some of these issues. Tom DiNapoli wrote a very interesting report highlighting Kanna Jhaiary's challenges back several years ago. And, you know, talking about an unsustainable burden on taxpayers if nothing were done. Obviously, he's responded to the Detroit bankruptcy. You know, we also have Lieutenant Governor Ravitch, who's involved, ex-Lieutenant Governor Ravitch, who wrote that report, who was involved in the New York City bond crisis
back in the day. Yeah.
And, you know, has written that state budget crisis task force report. So, you know, I mean, they're in New York, the comptroller's job is really important, and it's important that, you know, people begin to shine a light on this topic.
But you've made your choice. It's very interesting. From the very beginning, you've said the bondholders have to be paid.
Well, I've said that's how that the markets have said. I am not weighing in personally on whether I think that is who ought to come first in line. I think that's the political conversation we need to have.
Indeed.
As co-director of the joint Albany Law School University at Albany Institute for Financial Market Regulation, how do you get involved in what's happening?
Say that 8 times fast.
Yes. Right. how do you get involved in what's happening in Detroit? I mean, are you called on? What is the interest in both your organization and them in you?
Yeah, well, you know, a couple of things. I mean, I think in the Institute, we do several things. Number one, we try to train students to be the next generation of regulators and officials so that we can send people out into the world having had some of these conversations so that they hit the ground running. So that's one thing that we do. And the second thing that we do is we, you know, as academics, right, we write and talk about these issues. And we are a resource for public officials and, you know, for other academics thinking about these issues. So we support the work of certain public officials, you know, giving them information. They may call on us to look at a problem and to gather some background information,
perspective.
Yeah. And we, you know, we write articles and give talks that try to put issues out there for debate.
Do you take contracts from municipalities?
You know, we haven't, though we have certainly talked to municipalities about their issues. We also have done work respecting public authorities in New York, which is a conversation for another day, but like the Thruway Authority, the Dormitory Authority, huge borrowers, right?
Sure.
Big issuers of bonds. And so, and frankly, a lot that happens off the traditional budget.
So who pays for the Institute?
Well, our two schools do.
I see.
So for the last 50 minutes, we've been bumming people out.
No way.
Okay.
No way.
In the sense of that, you know, this is heavy stuff, and it's difficult to talk about because we're talking about cities and municipalities in crisis.
Right.
So for our final 4 minutes, let's talk about your optimism and what you're optimistic about and where your optimism lies in being able to overcome these troubles.
You know, I think I am optimistic. I mean, fundamentally, because I think that people work hard. And so, you know, I mean, people are working hard to provide services to cities and towns that residents want. You know, it's not a bunch, you know, we're not looking at it like any class of worker or stakeholder who isn't interested in the long-term vitality of their city or town. So I think that's critical. Number two, I think that, you know, look, nobody has lived through the crisis of the past few years without understanding that, you know, belt tightening is warranted. So I think that there is some willingness to begin to talk about what can we afford. I mean, you know, it's a conversation, right? But I do think, you know, we've all been managing our own household budgets. Okay. So the idea that a public official might come to us and say we need to manage our budget is not foreign territory.
But how far can you tighten a belt before you die? In other words, is there enough job base in our future 20 years from now as a country to sustain us?
No, I think that there is. I mean, I think that we have seen, and I think we'll continue to see a transition from a manufacturing economy.
That's an optimistic question.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to keep it light.
I'm the ray of sunshine. Yes. This is odd. The lawyer is the ray of sunshine. But you know, I mean,
it's part of your hourly.
Exactly.
It's fine.
Exactly. It's okay. It's going to be okay. No, but there is this movement towards a knowledge-based economy, and there is growth. And I do think, you know, fundamental investments in long-term economic growth are worth it. And I think we're making some of those. I mean, again, you know, democracy is messy. It's not to say that, you know, we can't just sort of declare from on high, we're done, we've got it sorted out, this is what you all will do.
Yeah.
But I do think there's reason for optimism in both the capacity for work and in the willingness to think about obligations, and frankly, the dedication of many public officials who are trying to work this out. So I think, you know, there are solutions. I'm not saying they won't be painful, but there are, you know, we can work out a path forward. And I do think that, you know, anything we can do to foster that will help us all. So yes, I think there's reason for optimism.
Well, you've been just terrific coming in and being able to explain these very complex issues to us and have them make sense. And I really appreciate you taking the time out, and not only in the work that you do, but sharing it with us this morning.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for talking about this subject
for
a long time. So really, I do appreciate it very much.
And the next time, authorities.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Next fair enough.
We can talk about public authorities on another day when the paint's wet again.
Be our sequel to this.
Thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure to have you. Professor Christine Chung, co-director of the Joint Albany Law School and University of Albany Institute for Financial Market Regulation. Alan.
I'm Ray. That's Alan.
Yeah, the name tags fell off.
Oh, ouch. Oh, man.
There's a lawyer present.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.